All right, welcome to KALW's live coverage of President-elect Joe Biden's speech coming up this evening at 5 o'clock. My name is Ethan Elkind. I'll be covering this along with our co-host Grace Wan. We're both from City Visions. Grace, glad you can join me for this.
Glad to be here, Ethan. Excited to hear what Joe Biden has to say at 5.
That's right. So this is a very historic election. It's obviously very important for the Bay Area in particular, because Kamala Harris is a local person. She's a local gal born in Oakland, and mom taught at UC Berkeley, or worked in the laboratory at UC Berkeley, and has really worn her East Bay, Bay Area roots proudly in this campaign. So this is very historic just for California and the Bay Area specifically.
I think it's great that California has a voice in the White House now. And also, I mean, Kamala Harris is the first graduate of an HBCU who's going to be taking office. So I think that's exciting for lots of communities in our state. And I know from some friends who are South Indian, they could not be more delighted. A lot of parties tonight to celebrate their Desi, Kamala Harris.
That's right. It's very historic. I mean, I think for a lot of people in the Bay Area, it's no secret that President Trump has not polled very well here. And so there's certainly a lot of celebration for all those opponents of the president and supporters of Biden and Kamala Harris. But I do think the historic nature of this, to have a woman now at the presidential ticket as vice president, maybe the thing that we talk the most about, you know, and when we think about this back to this election in the years to come.
Well, let me just give you a little bit of background about Kamala Harris. I mean, with this win, Senator Kamala Harris makes history, as we've talked about, as the country's first female vice president. She's the daughter of Indian and Jamaican immigrants. And as Ethan noted, she has deep ties to the Bay Area. She first came to prominence in 2004 when she was elected as San Francisco's district attorney. Following that, she served as the state's attorney general. And in 2016, she won a seat in the U.S. Senate. 3 years later, in 2019, she launched her own presidential campaign, but withdrew late that year, citing fundraising woes. In August of this year, Biden announced that Harris was his choice for vice president. And to talk more about the historical milestone of having not only a female vice president, but also a woman of color, we're pleased to be joined by Christine Pelosi, the chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. Good afternoon, Christine.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Give us a little bit of context about Christine, about Kamala. What does it mean to you that she is the new vice president?
Well, I think it's absolutely amazing. Kamala Harris is a dear friend of mine. I met her first at law school in San Francisco, University of California, Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco Civic Center. And I worked with her. Our times overlapped briefly in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office when she was head of the Career Criminal Division, and I was in the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Unit. And obviously, as chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus for the past 10 years, and Kamala being elected statewide for the past 10 years in California, I have seen her strengths grow, the grassroots support for her around the state just to continue to not only expand but deepen, as people have seen her as a fighter for consumers, as a fighter for criminal justice reform, really changing some of her own views in terms of being smart on crime and what that looks like as we start to correct some of the grave errors of the war on drugs. And then, of course, you know, the irony of 2016, when we all thought Hillary Clinton was going to be president, Kamala Harris was going to be a senator who would be a strong ally and advocate of President Clinton to help her advance her agenda. And after what some might have even called a cautious campaign for U.S. Senate, really was Kamala's, if you go back and look at Kamala Harris's victory speech in 2016, it was really the moment where she picked up the mantle of the resistance and just said, America, we're looking in the mirror. And if we don't like what we see, then we have to act. And from then, you know, Kamala went all around the country campaigning for people. And I can tell you, as a member of the Democratic National Committee, people often ask me for Californians. They ask me for my mom, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of course. They ask me for people like Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, who they want to come to their dinners and their endorsement events around the country. But one of the top people that people asked me for was our brand new senator, Kamala Harris. And she did go travel all around the country during the 2017 and 2018 cycle. And I think that really gave her a lot of goodwill not to mention knowledge of people around the country. And so even though her presidential campaign fell short because she didn't have the money to compete when it was time to get on the ballot, she was well known, and she was still asked by her Senate colleagues to go to campaign for them in their primaries as well as their general election. So I think Joe Biden looked at all of that, looked at her friendship with his late son, Beau Biden, a really wonderful person whom I knew for his service with veterans and military families, and looked at the strengths that she could bring to the ticket. So it's not, I think, just the history that Kamala Harris brings as a Southeast Asian woman, as a Black woman, to ascend to the vice presidency, but it's also, I think, telling of the character of Joe Biden, that he was strong enough and secure enough to pick somebody of a different race, gender, and generation who had campaigned against him pretty aggressively when the two of them were campaigning for president.
Yeah, absolutely. And Christine, this is Ethan Elkind just weighing in here. And I think it's an interesting bookends, too, that you had the first African-American president kind of bring Joe Biden along to serve him. And then now you've got Joe Biden bringing Kamala Harris as the first person of Asian descent, first woman to take that position as vice president. But I wanted to ask you, since you know, you know, met now Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, you know, what personal qualities and what strengths do you think she'll bring to this office? And I guess as part of that question, are there particular issues that you would envision that she'll likely really own as vice president? Well, Christine, I'm not sure if did we lose you? Well, we might have lost.
Yeah,
might have lost Christine there, but that was Christine Pelosi's chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus, and sharing some of her perspectives on Kamala Harris as someone in California politics who knows Kamala well. Well, we also have Sonia Narang, KALW's election coverage manager, who has been standing by, and we do hope to get Christine back, but we also wanted to go to Sonia. And so, Sonia, if you can hear me, it would be we'd love to hear from you about what this historic election here and the ascendancy of Kamala Harris to the vice presidency, what that means for you. And particularly, I should ask Sonia too, this as a person of South Asian descent, what that means to have Kamala Harris in this position.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, Sonia, we've got you.
Hello, hi. Yes, I have been talking to a lot of my family members here in California about what this means. And, you know, it's something that has been a moment that's been a long time coming. You know, someone who myself, as an Indian American, has waited a long time to see a female of Indian heritage achieve such a high ranking in the administration has been a proud moment for not just me, but for my family. I mean, just today I've been texting with many of my cousins from West Coast to East Coast, and, you know, the entire clan is here in LA. So all my Narang cousins have been texting me to say that it's finally a moment that they can see someone as a role model. A lot of them are parents of young kids, and they have now a role model, a female, first of all, that their young girls and boys can look up to, and then a person of color. Another big thing is her Berkeley connection. I'm a UC Berkeley graduate as well. And to just hear the stories that Kamala Harris told on the campaign trail about her parents and how they met at Berkeley is such a California story. And to see that there can be such success coming out of my home state and coming at a time when people have just been waiting for change. I mean, my dad came to LA over 50 years ago, and he told me today this is something he could have never, ever dreamt of. So it has been a very big moment for myself, my family, and my friends.
Well, and certainly, I think you mentioned a lot of the big picture, you know, reasons for folks to be excited about Kamala Harris. I mean, you mentioned certainly the South Asian connection, the Berkeley connection for those of us here in the Bay Area. And I'm wondering, Sonia, since you're down in L.A., what is the mood down there? I mean, we know Kamala Harris has moved down to Los Angeles. So is there kind of an ownership over Kamala Harris down in Los Angeles as well? And what's the general mood down there?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting watching reactions. There was you know, dancing in the streets of downtown LA, fireworks going off in downtown, you know, people in Echo Park were cheering and whistling from their homes. You know, and LA is a city that, you know, has strongly supported the Democrats. There are pockets, though, of Republicans here. So it's, you know, there is a wide swath of support. But again, you know, it's been interesting. Like, I myself have had to be a little bit muted about my own personal celebrations because of this worry that, yes, there are still, you know, supporters, that can, you know, that are, not in, you know, on the other side. So, you know, I think that it's something that has been a little bit, muted, but there were cheers breaking out around downtown. It just depends where you are in LA. You know, I do think that it's something that all of California is owning, not just Los Angeles. But people here seem to be very proud of this moment.
Well, it's certainly a very big deal. And like I said, I think especially for California, I mean, it's been a long time since we've even had a Californian anywhere on the presidential ticket. I think you got to go back to Ronald Reagan in the 80s. So that's a big deal for California, which is often overlooked when it comes to presidential politics, being such a deep blue state. So now all of a sudden, you know, we've got some local leadership now in the highest offices of the land. I wanted to ask you also, Sonia, and just let listeners know, this is Sonia Narang, who's KALW's election coverage manager. I also wanted to ask you about COVID. We've already heard that the president-elect Joe Biden is going to make an announcement about a COVID task force. What do you see as the immediate steps there that need to be put in place? What are you hearing about, you know, what the president-elect's plan might be, and I suppose how Kamala Harris might fit into that?
Exactly. Well, you know, this is one of the most critical moments, I feel, looking at the next few months when it comes to this pandemic. LA, as you know, was one of the major hotspots in California. It was, in fact, the epicenter of California's COVID-19 outbreak. And, you know, struggled early on with controlling the disease. So, you know, hearing about President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris working on this task force, you know, they've already announced this 12-person task force with some incredible people behind them as their co-chairs. They have former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who I actually got to meet in San Francisco a few years ago at the Asian American Journalists Association conference. He's got the former FDA Commissioner David Kessler, Yale University's Dr. Marcela Nunez-Smith. And, you know, just to hear that he's got a strong contingent of people looking at how to ramp up not just testing, but, you know, also the wearing of masks, vaccines. You know, I think that's going to be a big deal, not just for people in Southern California, but throughout the state and the country. So that's something that we have our eyes on, especially as we go into this second wave, into the winter months, which obviously we don't have to face as hard as the East Coast. But, you know, just hearing about these plans is sort of a ray of hope for many people here.
Absolutely. And I want to let listeners know, too, that we'd love to hear from you. So if you want to dial in and let us know what you make of this historic day today with Joe Biden announced as a president-elect, Kamala Harris as a vice president-elect, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at kalw@kalw.org. Grace and I are going to be online for another 6 minutes. And actually, let me hand it back over to Grace, because it sounds like we might have gotten Christine back.
Yeah, Christine, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, thanks so much. Sorry for those audio issues. One of the questions that we wanted to know is, what issues do you think that Kamala Harris will take during the Biden-Harris administration? Are there areas of interest that she particularly will be in charge of?
Well, I think that Kamala Harris made it very clear that she expects to essentially have the same deal with Joe Biden that Joe Biden had with Barack Obama. That is to say, to have the ability to weigh in on every issue and to be the last person in the room when the president is making a decision. That said, obviously her strengths are...
Yeah, her
city and in a lot of the reach to... and community never the table like hers will be in the Oval Office.
Well, we appreciate that insight into what a Harris-Biden administration might look like. And thank you so much to Christine Pelosi for joining us this afternoon on a historic day. Just a quick question. How's your mom feeling? I think we've lost Christine Pelosi, but I think we might be able to guess how Nancy Pelosi might be feeling today. What do you think, Ethan?
Well, you know, it's interesting with speaking of Nancy Pelosi, because the Democrats did really underperformed in the House. And so there's a lot of heat now clearly on her to sort of take maybe some responsibility for why things went, you know, much more poorly than they expected. I think she's probably going to be a lock to be reelected by her caucus as speaker. But she did pledge to just serve out one more term here, so through 2022, and we'll see how that goes. But otherwise, I think clearly for Democrats, having the executive branch is key. I think all eyes now will turn to the Senate and this runoff election that's coming up in Georgia in January. So that, I think, is going to loom large. I wanted to get back to Sonia Narang, if that's all right. KALW's election coverage manager. Sonia, we thank you for standing by. One question for you around the international community. I know you have a network of international journalists that you're in touch with. What are you hearing about the international reaction to the announcement that Joe Biden is the president-elect?
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, this morning I got a flurry of WhatsApps. You know, I usually communicate with my international friends over the WhatsApp text messaging platform, and most of them were, you know, very interested in the climate change angle. You know, for a lot of my journalist colleagues overseas in Europe and Asia and Africa, you know, they are very concerned about how this can impact the climate. Many of them have been following President-elect Joe Biden's stance on the Paris Accords. That's the climate change accord that the United States joined in late 2015 at the COP21 summit, where I actually was present when that decision was made for the United States to join. So a lot of them are now, you know, texting me to say, wow, that's interesting that the U.S. is going to reverse the stance under President Trump, who backed out of that agreement. You know, a lot of them are also interested in what it means for diplomatic relations with Europe. These are the journalists I know in Europe. And, you know, another interesting factor is because I am South Asian and have a lot of friends and relatives in India, many of them have been texting me how excited they are to see the first Indian American vice president elect, Kamala Harris. And, you know, just this morning I was hearing about how, you know, they're just looking forward to seeing President-elect Harris come to India for the first time and what it would mean for Indian politicians to welcome her on their soil. So that's something that they're looking forward to.
To that end, Sonia, I mean, this afternoon, Rahul Gandhi, the grandson of Indira Gandhi, tweeted, "It makes us proud that the first woman to serve as vice president of the USA traces her roots to India." So it is a historic day for Harris and the Biden administration. We're coming up to the end of our segment, and I wanted to thank you and also Christine Pelosi earlier for coming in and telling us a little bit about your thoughts and your observations about the historic election of Biden and Harris. And with that, we're KALW, Public Radio, 91.7 FM, and we'll get back to you soon.
Yeah, we'll be back that 35 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for more local coverage as we go back to NPR in anticipation of this big speech from President-elect Joe Biden coming up at 5 o'clock. So stick with us, KLW, you'll get your national news, and you'll get your local coverage as well.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Joe Biden has been elected the 46th president of the United States, according to the Associated Press, ending a turbulent election season. The AP says Biden has 290 electoral votes to President Trump's 214. The news sent people to the streets to celebrate in cities around the country with cheering and honking horns. Trump is vowing to continue to fight the vote counts. World leaders are congratulating President-elect Biden, but not all. So far, no word from Russian President Vladimir Putin or from Brazil's President Bolsonaro. Coronavirus infections and deaths continue to rise around Europe. French health officials say the country has topped 40,000 COVID-19 deaths for the first time. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Total Wine & More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com. And from Rocket Mortgage, working to help homebuyers find a home loan that fits their budget. Homebuyers can adjust payments, see tax estimates, and closing costs, all in real time. Rocket Mortgage. Rocket can.
This is special coverage from All Things Considered on NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. You look at the electoral map now and you see that Joe Biden won Pennsylvania. Joe Biden won Nevada. And with that, he is president-elect with electoral votes to spare. And the president-elect is expected to speak to the nation later tonight.
But as we await those remarks from him, we want to learn more about what a Biden presidency could mean for foreign policy. And to start that conversation off, we're joined by Admiral James Stavridis. He led the NATO Alliance and Global Operations from 2009 to 2013 and is the former dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Welcome, Admiral Stavridis. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
What a night, and happy to be with you.
I see that. You're happy to be with us. So, and earlier today, you tweeted your congratulations to President-elect Biden, and you added, quote, go make some history and heal this nation. So talk a bit more about that, like why you're so happy, for example, and what do you think healing the nation will take?
Well, first of all, let's look at the triumph of hope over fear. You know, Napoleon said, I love to quote Napoleon because I'm 5 feet, 5 inches tall. Napoleon said that a leader is a dealer in hope. And I think that we have a leader in President-elect Biden who will lead with hope. Number two, and this is my zone, the international world, President Biden will be looking to build bridges, not to build walls. And we have seen this Trump administration again and again try and withdraw from the world, pull out of treaties, denigrate international organizations, criticize my beloved NATO. We are going to have a president in President Biden who's going to seek to build bridges. So in summary, it's hope over fear, it's bridges over walls. Over time, that will be the prescription to heal the nation, in my view.
Well, you just referenced the President Trump's kind of China shop breaking approach to a number of issues of governing, both in domestic politics and in the international arena, pulling out of diplomatic agreements, starting a trade war with China. But obviously, there is a significant number of people who supported his approach in the big picture, if not in all the details. So how do you think that President-elect Biden should now proceed? Can he just sort of go back to the way things were? Or is there some adjustment needed to accommodate the reality that has been made clear that a number of people actually agree with President Trump or on a number of these issues?
There are always adjustments to be made. And I'll tell you three things that I think a President Biden will bring to the table that will help. Number one, he'll bring a great team. He's got people like Michelle Flournoy, Susan Rice, Jay Johnson, Nick Burns, Bill Burns, Tony Blinken. These are deeply experienced, near cabinet level individuals who served for 8 years with him. He'll bring them, and this is key, he's not going to rotate them on a revolving door basis. President Trump's had four national security advisors in 4 years. That's no way to run foreign policy. So number one, great team, stable team. Number two, I believe that a President Biden will look to rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. He will work with the World Health Organization. He'll work with the United Nations, the Organization of American States, to deal with Venezuela. He'll look to engage, not to denigrate, these international organizations. And third and finally, you mentioned China. I think that's the uber issue for the United States as this 21st century unfolds. Here I look for the formulation of a strategy, not just a transactional theory that touches issues, each is an oars, but rather steps back, builds a theory, builds a strategy, and then implements it. So I am bullish on American prospects going forward in the world. And I'll conclude with this. I think that is demonstrable to the American public. They can understand why that will be good for America going forward. So yeah, there'll be changes, there'll be differences, but I think overall we're headed in a good direction internationally with this team.
We know that President Trump has damaged some relationships with foreign leaders, even allies. They have made that clear themselves. What do you think needs to happen now to improve America's standing abroad? Is there something that you would recommend to the president-elect that he perhaps pursue as a priority in this first 100 days, that kind of classic time frame?
I think the world is very concerned about climate and should be. And therefore, President Biden has already indicated he will rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. That is powerful. Number two, he ought to reach out to world leaders, and I'm encouraged that a number have called him already. Some have not, but that will follow. And I'll tell you something about President-elect Biden. When he was vice president, he came to NATO. When I was Supreme Allied Commander, we were hosting a dinner for him with 28 foreign ministers and ambassadors of all the nations in NATO. He went around the table one by one, and he was able to give a story, tell a particular remark, make a comment about his visit to that nation. He is a powerful force because of his experience in the international world. So let that forth. His relationships around the world are going to help us significantly. I think those are the two things I would say up front. Okay. Get back into Paris, use your personal connections around the world, and be the kind of leader that the world wants out of the United States of America.
That's Admiral James Stavridis. Admiral, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Admiral Stavridis has launched our discussion of what Joe Biden's election means for the world. Let's continue that discussion now with one of the world's best teams of international correspondents. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman joins us, as well as NPR's Frank Langford in London and NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Welcome to all of you.
Hi, Steve.
Thank you.
Great to be here, Steve.
And let's get the big picture from Michelle Kellerman. We've already heard the beginnings of Joe Biden's foreign policy priorities. How different is his approach to his predecessor?
Well, I think it's what you heard Admiral Stavridis talk about. The big priority is rebuilding alliances. That's why we're hearing kind of a sigh of relief in a lot of places in Europe, for instance, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, the World Health Organization, a return to a kind of more multilateral approach to the world. But he's also talked about a foreign policy that benefits the American middle class. And, you know, there was this group of foreign policy experts, some close to Biden, who went to Nebraska, Colorado, and Ohio recently to hear the views of Americans. They found there, you know, a lot of support for Trump's tough talk about China, but also a pragmatic view about trade, immigration, and dealing with China. You know, they want trade deals that protect American jobs, global leadership, but also not an overextended America. So I think some of those themes are going to be important for a Joe Biden presidency.
Let me ask about the way that President Trump has embraced strongmen. Remarkably, remarkably deferential to Russia's Vladimir Putin, said he's friends with President Xi Jinping of China, even as he launched a trade war against him, the relationship with the leader of North Korea. We could go on and on. He was criticized for this, and yet every U.S. president tries to manage relations with various strongmen around the world, hopefully in the interest of peace. How, if at all, would Biden be any different?
Right. Well, I mean, Biden does have close personal relationships with a lot of leaders, but you're not going to see Biden praising Vladimir Putin. You will see him working together with Putin to extend New START, an arms control agreement with Russia. You won't see Biden exchanging love letters with Kim Jong-un, but you will see him trying to get denuclearization talks going on the Korean Peninsula. Saudi Arabia is another one to watch, Steve. You know, Trump went there on his first overseas trip. Biden has made clear that he's going to pull back U.S. aid to the Saudi military campaign in Yemen, for instance, and raise human rights concerns more than Trump did. Progressives in the Democratic Party are going to be pushing him to do more of that.
Okay, Frank Langfitt in London. The UK, of course, is the closest ally of the United States, has been. Boris Johnson is somebody very much in sympathy with President Trump and has a similar political approach. How has Boris Johnson taken his personal ally's defeat?
Well, he offered congratulations and mentioned the relation, what they call the special relationship here. And he talked about an ability to look at trade, security, working on climate change, just like the Admiral and just like Michelle were mentioning. We are going to have the major climate change meeting coming up in Glasgow next year. So that will be an opportunity for them to work together. But obviously, Boris Johnson, very close to President Trump by comparison. And so that's a little awkward.
Do we know how Joe Biden feels about Boris Johnson?
Yeah, we get the sense he's not a fan at all. I think this could be a big reversal of fortune, not so much necessarily for Britain writ large, but definitely for Boris Johnson. So last year, Joe Biden referred to Boris Johnson as kind of a physical and emotional clone of President Trump. And back in 2016, when a bust of Churchill was removed from the Oval Office, Johnson suggested it might be part of the Kenyan president's ancestral dislike of the British Empire. So he may have regretted writing that, frankly, now. And also, Biden, it's interesting, Biden is of Irish descent. He's also warned Johnson in his negotiations with the EU not to do anything that could threaten the peace agreement in Northern Ireland. And this evening, there was an exchange between a BBC reporter and President-elect Biden, and it went like this.
Mr. Biden, a quick word for the BBC.
The BBC, I'm Irish.
I'm Irish. Now, he was smiling when he said that, but it's just you get a sense of here is a new kind of leader with maybe a little bit of a different relationship with Boris Johnson and maybe a little different view of the United Kingdom.
Irish and the British haven't always gotten along, to say the least. Rob,
historically they have not, Steve. There's a bitter, bitter history, and I spent a lot of time in Ireland, and everybody there remembers it quite clearly.
Very briefly, Rob, what is the response in Germany to this news?
I think it's fair to say German, as well as many European leaders, are collectively exhaling a sigh of relief today. President Trump has been a thorn in the side of Berlin from day one, whether it was his constant badgering of Germany to spend more on national defense or billions of dollars worth of tariffs and German exports, or his removal of the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord or the Iran nuclear deal. He was likely the most difficult U.S. president Germany has had to deal with in the post-war era. The most recent Pew survey showed that just 10% of Germans were confident in Trump's handling of world affairs.
And what can change, though? I mean, there are differences between Germany and the United States, differences over NATO, lots of things.
Right. I think, you know, our return to civility is going to be one change. You know, the tone of transatlantic dialogue will immediately change. I think we'll also see an eagerness by both sides to get back to work on problems that the two nations have in common to search for common solutions. I spoke to Constanze Steltemüller about this. She's a senior fellow at Brookings, and here's what she said.
Biden is never going to call the EU a foe. Biden is going to look at the EU and say, this is a very useful source of leverage and additional power in dealing with issues that are important to America.
Okay, so that is one perspective from Europe. But while I have Rob Schmitz and Frank Langfitt, I want to ask about one more country. And I want people who don't recall that both of you have covered China. Both of you speak Chinese and know the country very well. And this is the most important relationship in the world. It's been difficult for one American president after another. And President Trump had a particular approach. What changes now?
Well, Steve, we just heard from Constanze Steltemüller talking about issues that are important to America for Europe. And one of those big issues is going to be dealing with a more powerful and aggressive China. Both the U.S. and the EU have been trying to tackle this issue the past 4 years, but Trump made it very difficult by driving a wedge between the U.S. and Germany, as well as the European Union. Suddenly, all parties were dealing with China separately, which benefited Beijing greatly. And now it looks like we're going to have alliance with the EU and America that will be facing China.
Frank Langford, about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, I think that what Biden will be hoping for is to work with the EU to still continue a very assertive policy, but one that is far more strategic than what President Trump has been pursuing.
And I suppose we should mention this is something that foreign policy experts have talked about, the possibility of the United States gaining leverage on a resistant China by gaining alliances. The Obama administration attempted something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Pacific allies, and there is now talk of a stronger, more coordinated effort between the United States and the European Union to confront China and try to continue to set the rules of the world. That's NPR's Frank Langfitt, Michelle Kellerman, and Rob Schmitz. You're listening to special coverage on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Grace Wan and Ethan Elkind. You're listening to KALW San Francisco. We're your hosts for tonight's local coverage as President-elect Biden addresses the nation tonight. We expect his remarks to begin at 5 p.m., and we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at KALW at KALW.org to share your views about today's election results. We're here also, we also are going to be joined by Janae Darden, KALW's East Oakland reporter, to talk about her reaction to the Bay Area's, to the celebration of Joe Biden's election. Hi, Janae.
Hi.
How are you?
You're good.
I'm fine. When the election was called this morning, I could hear cars honking outside my house in San Francisco, and my kids were shouting about it. What did you see in Alameda County?
Same, exactly. I heard horns, as you, just like you, people honking, saying yay, yay. I actually went to a rally in Alameda, which is where I live, to their city hall, and there were people out with signs, you know, saying "Go Kamala," you know, "Go Joe Biden," and honking and dancing.
That seems like a pretty good reaction. The Bay Area views Kamala Harris as one of their own, and she's someone who identifies with so many communities given her diverse background. One she speaks fondly of a lot is her time as a member of a Black sorority while she was at Howard. Sorority sisters came out in strong support of her during the election. What's your view of that, Janae?
Yeah, so she's a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. They're the first African-American sorority. I'm also a member of a sorority, not that one. I'm a member of Sigma Gamma Rho. And basically, if you may recall, when she gave a speech at the convention, Democratic convention, she mentioned the Divine Nine, which are all of the nine Black fraternities and sororities. So she kind of put the bat call out and basically, you know, and galvanized. And so that definitely helped. Because a lot of women in her sorority are involved in politics, are very esteemed professionals. And so, you know, they went out along with and the other Black sororities and fraternities too collaborated. They went out and registered people to vote and did play a strong role in her getting elected. So she put the bat call out.
And Janae, this is Ethan Elkind here. So glad that you can join us here from the eye from the East Bay side of things. And it's certainly a very big deal to have Kamala Harris, you know, local gal here represented at the highest offices of the land. I wanted to ask you a question about one of the issues that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris campaigned on, which was this issue of racial justice. You know, obviously we saw a lot of protests this summer, and that's something that President-elect Biden has pledged to take immediate action on. Do you anticipate, and from what you're hearing in the community there, do you anticipate that Kamala Harris is likely to kind of take ownership over that issue for President-elect Joe Biden, or do you anticipate other issues, given Kamala Harris's roots in the East Bay, that she might be particularly well suited to take on as vice president?
Well, no, I saw her on 60 Minutes, and she spoke about as far as the role she would play, and that, you know, Joe Biden would, you know, they would work closely together, and she would give her opinion, you know, of issues. And so the fact that, you know, she is someone who is a woman of color, her parents were very much involved in the civil rights movement. She's the daughter of immigrants. So she can bring that perspective, you know, to Joe Biden. I would hope they will work together, collaborate on that, and not just that all fall on her and put all that pressure on the Black Indian woman, you know, as far as to bridge racial relations. But, you know, people today I talk to are very hopeful that she's there. I talked to a number of immigrants, and they were hopeful and excited that she's there. I mean, some of them were afraid they were going to get deported, people that I talked to, so that she can bring that experience of diversity, of being, you know, a daughter of immigrants. They think will make a difference.
Well, I was going to ask about that because I think, you know, we've seen those protests even under the Obama administration. I mean, you might have, you know, presumably a more favorable administration towards issues of racial justice. But do you think, and is your sense from talking to people in the community, that having Kamala Harris there in the White House as, you know, as a vice president, if that will help diffuse some of the kind of tension and anger? I mean, obviously, we're still going to have these problems ongoing in our country, but at least for folks who are protesting, feeling like now they have maybe more of an advocate or an ally in the White House.
Yeah, so I was talking to a friend this morning, and, you know, we were concerned about how, you know, we see such a surge from white supremacists. And, you know, she was saying she was hoping that hopefully that will, and this is the one who's Latina I was talking to, she was saying she was hoping, I'm hearing people cheering outside right now, so I'm talking, but excuse me, and honking, but she said she was hoping that would kind of slow their roll, basically, because we saw, you know, how the current president energized white supremacists. But, I mean, again, you know, Senator Harris, or Vice President-elect Harris, she has that background, and I read her biography. She's, you know, she's been talking about kind of bridging, you know, as far as the racial divide. But people I talked to today, they said it's going to take, you know, we can't put everything on Biden and Harris. You know, we all have to work together. We saw that with Black Lives Matter, you know, activism over the summer, as you mentioned, Ethan, like, we can't, you know, people are saying, like, we can't just put it all on these elected officials, that the community, that the people have to get involved, and the people voted, you know.
One thing we've seen a lot on social media, Janae, are pictures of parents and guardians posting photos of their children, their daughters especially, saying, oh, my gosh, there's somebody in office who looks like me. And I can't believe that there's finally a woman who is going to be the vice president. And maybe we'll have a female president one day. In the community and what you're seeing today, what's been the response been to having someone that people can identify with in a higher office?
Yeah, actually, I spoke with a woman today in Alameda about that, because she has two daughters, 1 3, 1 6, and she has an eight-year-old son. And she says she was really excited that they have a role model to look up to, who's a woman and who's actually from here locally. And she said that her name is Hannah Green. And she said that Kamala Harris being vice president-elect solidifies what she's been teaching her children about equality and feminism, because now we're seeing reflected it more in the government.
It feels like it's a long time coming.
Yeah, it does.
Well, it's the fourth try. You know, if you think about it, we had Geraldine Ferraro in 1984, and then we had Sarah Palin in 2008, and Hillary Clinton in 2016, and this is finally on the fourth time a woman on
Shirley
the ticket.
Chisholm. Shirley Chisholm ran too for president too. So
that's correct.
Yeah.
So yes. It has been a while. Well, I'm curious, Janae. So, you know, obviously the symbolic value of having a woman of color now as vice president, and certainly from the Bay Area, is a big deal. But from a policy perspective, what is your sense, you know, from the community in the East Bay, where you report from? What is the sense of the sort of the big policy asks and hopes that the community is looking to get out of a Biden-Harris administration?
I mean, well, definitely, you know, with policing, just the issues of, you know, people being unjustly harmed, you know, by police. So as far as, you know, improving police reform, that's a huge issue that a lot of people have been talking about. Healthcare. I know people are very, very concerned about healthcare, and, you know, saving the Affordable Care Act or having a better plan. Those are definitely two issues that have come up. especially in light of the recent appointment of Supreme Court Justice. I know some people, that was the first thing they said, I'm going to lose my health care. So I know those are definitely two issues. And then the economy, I mean, you know, in Alameda and other parts of the Bay Area, I'm seeing so many stores and restaurants that I love that I boarded up. So, you know, in light of all of that, you know, how about the economy and of course, COVID. So the pandemic, we're talking about healthcare and the pandemic.
So certainly a lot on the plate.
It's a lot.
I mean, it's kind of amazing if you think about what President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris are going to be inheriting now. I mean, you just rattled off a number of major significant issues that people are going to be expecting some action on. And if you're just tuning in, by the way, I want to let you know you're listening to Janae Darden, KALW's East Oakland reporter. And we also want to hear from you as we're leading up to President-elect Biden's big speech. You can call in. We'd love to hear what you're thinking of this historic moment. And the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Love to have you join the conversation, hear your perspective about this big announcement, what it means for the Bay Area, what it might mean for you personally. You can also email us at kalw@kalw.org. Well, Janae, one thing that has become clear out of this is that we are in a very divided country, and there are high hopes for Kamala Harris and Joe Biden to try to solve some of these problems. But the election results in many ways didn't go as Democrats had hoped. You know, losing seats in the House, the Senate now is going to be down to a double runoff, it looks like, in Georgia, which is not the friendliest of terrain traditionally for Democrats. Do you think there's going to be patience among the community where you report from, Janae, just more broadly for, you know, the challenges of trying to compromise now? You know, high hopes for them coming into office, but the reality of getting deals done with the Senate may be pretty difficult. So what is your sense about the mood, if there's patience for this and understanding of what they're facing in office?
Well, you know, I spoke with someone who volunteered for the campaign, and they did robocalls, and she's already said, she's an Alameda resident as well, and she said they're gearing up to go, you know, to help out in Georgia. So right now, from what I'm reading, people I'm engaged with online, people are saying like, okay, we got to get Georgia. So that's what the left is saying. So even though, and people are saying, we're not done. So like, even though, you know, they've been elected, Biden Harris have been elected, that they're not done.
It sounds like they need to put out the bat call, Janae. I think that's what Kamala is doing.
The bat call has already been put out. the other bat call has been put out. Because even, you know, I was talking about the black sororities and fraternities. The mayor of Atlanta is in a black sorority. So that bat call has been put out. And just from other groups too as well, you know, and other activists, they're going to be doing work in Georgia. So, you may see some Bay Area people, Californians too as well, trying to get those Senate seats, those blue Senate seats in Georgia.
Well, it's been so great to talk to you and hearing your observations on the ground, Janae. That was Janae Darden, our East Oakland reporter. And now we're going to be joined by Ben Trefney. He's the KAL News Director. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. So tell us, what was it like at about 8:40 this morning where you were in terms of hearing the news?
Well, definitely. There was a lot of excitement on the streets. And, you know, it reminded me of when the San Francisco Giants won their first World Series in 2010, and there were all these people who were just shouting and screaming outside of their houses, just letting it go. I think there's just been so much pent up that I just heard a lot of that. And really, you know, while the media made this declaration today, and then as soon as one said that Biden was the winner, and then the others kind of fell into place, I think that we've known for at least 24 hours, if not 48 hours, that this was the way the tide was turning. So I think people were just waiting. And then as soon as it happened, they just went off. There were actually some really big parties that are still happening in San Francisco's Castro District and in the Mission District. And one of our colleagues, Janae and my colleagues, and Sonia's David Boyer, was out there. And we put a post up on KALW.org that shows the scene in the Castro District. And David told me that strangers were just connected by the moment. Lots of horns and thumbs up. And to him, it felt like gay pride in the Castro. And it definitely looks like that. You should check out KALW.org.
It feels like, given how 2020 has been and we've all been sort of shut inside, it was the celebration outside that everybody wanted. The weather's been great today. People are feeling really good. I noticed in front of the White House, it seems that thousands have reclaimed the song YMCA that Trump was using for his campaign.
Well, one thing to note about that too, Grace, is that, you know, you think that the Bay Area is the liberal bubble, right? Well, I know from talking with friends in D.C., the D.C. vote came out like 95% for Biden.
Right.
And so it's not a surprise. There would be a pretty similar scene there.
Well, and I have some friends, Ben, just to your point about the celebrations, obviously, I have some friends who found out the news because they heard all the honking and the cheering. And someone on Twitter, it's almost as if, at least for these sort of blue cities like Washington, D.C. and San Francisco, it's almost as if the United States just won a war or something. I mean, it seems like it's at that level of celebration. I mean, again, a very divided country.
Yeah, it depends on where you're at.
Exactly. But certainly in these urban blue parts of the country, we're seeing a lot of these celebrations, as you noted. And I think it's great that you were able to post this on KALW.org. I hope people can go to that, to our webpage and see that. I'm also curious, Ben, about the voter turnout in San Francisco. You mentioned Washington, D.C. What was it like in San Francisco in terms of mailed ballots and kind of what the general turnout was like?
Sure. Well, I thought it was pretty fascinating because San Francisco, just a couple days ago, when they had finished about 24 hours worth of reports, they had reported that about two-thirds of registered voters had voted. And I thought that was interesting. It sounded like it was pretty low. So I actually checked the city's historical data. And, you know, that was kind of a typical amount, even a high amount, up until the year 2000 for San Francisco registered voter turnout. And of course, in 2000 was when there was the Bush v. Gore controversial election, and people really realized how much their votes counted. So in the presidential election after that in 2004, we had about a 75% voter turnout. But then what happened after that, which I found really fascinating historically in San Francisco, is that when there were two new candidates for president, you ended up having around an 80% voter turnout, you know, 4 out of 5 registered voters. But when it was a year when you had an incumbent running, then it was sinking back down again, more like just above 70%. So this year, I was thinking, as I looked around the nation and seeing all the historical voter turnout, I'm thinking, wow, well, San Francisco just didn't quite do it, and it fits their trends because there's an incumbent running. But as it turns out now, Ethan, because of the vote-by-mail ballots and so many people, I think, who turned their ballots in on Election Day or dropped it in the mailbox on Election Day, we're up to historical highs. So it is now 84% of San Francisco's registered voters voted in this election. And I also saw that 7 out of 8 of them voted for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
So is that actually down a little bit, 7 out of 8? I'm just wondering, or is that pretty consistent with what we've seen with past elections and sort of the blue-red split in San Francisco?
Oh, 7. Well, 7 out of 8 is, I think that that's pretty typical. I mean, you know, reliably, at least for the last several elections, certainly, you know, through the Obama years, I think that that's pretty consistent. And, you know, surprising to me that D.C. is so much more. But also we saw in this election, as we're watching the returns come in, Philadelphia is something around that as well. And that's why you saw that, you know, Pennsylvania switch.
I think something about this election that people will take with them is how difficult it is to vote. Here in California and San Francisco, it was fairly easy. You got your ballot, you could drop it in somewhere, and we would take San Francisco would take your ballot as long as it was postmarked. But for the last couple of days, I think we really have seen how hard it is to vote in different states and counties across the country.
Yeah, I actually have a story about that too. My kids are 18 years old. They both went to college. They're actually in dorms. We weren't sure it was going to happen, but they are, and taking, you know, classes by distance learning. But my son is in Oregon, and he voted as a registered Californian. But my daughter is in Arizona, and she was interested in voting as an Arizonan. But it was so difficult for her to actually register there. She tried to do something that was online. That didn't work. She went to people who were on campus, and that didn't work either because she actually wanted to register with a certain party, and they were just registering basically people who were of the other party. So she, who did not have a car, would have had to go someplace that was many, many, many miles away in order to register in person, and it was just too much of a hassle. So that was just a personal anecdote around that, and let alone where there were greater efforts to suppress voters around the country.
It seems like Arizona needs a Stacey Abrams.
Well, she made a huge difference, right? I mean, I saw something about how she's helped to register something like 800,000 voters. And when you have a difference of maybe 8,000 voters in the end, I mean, she might have, at least as far as Georgia goes, might have won this election and maybe even turned the Senate.
Well, the other thing that Stacey Abrams did is that she and others with her helped advocate and get passed a law in Georgia that had automatic voter registration. And I think a lot of people are also pointing to the critical need to have those kinds of policies to see the types of turnout that we've been seeing, certainly in Georgia and other states. And Grace, I know you worked as a nonpartisan election observer in the state of Nevada. Did you see any kind of differences in Nevada versus California? How did that go for you?
It was pretty, there was not much to see. When democracy works, it works smoothly, it's fairly boring. I sat and watched a drop box, and people just came in, they got their votes scanned, and they put in a 300-pound drop box, and that was it. And people were surprised at how uneventful the process was, because I think the media and the commentary from Trump and his campaign had created a lot of anxiety for people about how their votes would be cast, how their votes would be counted. People wanted to make sure that their ballots were tracked, which is something that's more new in this election than in the past. So coming out of 2020, I think that this is something that we'll all be taking with us, that we expect that our ballots will be cast, that we could track them. And if we can't track them, then we're going to be worried.
Well, I guess it's good that it's boring. This is what you want to see,
yes.
A boring election. There was a lot of concern that there would be civil unrest, some violence, and we didn't see that, thankfully, on Election Day. So far, the protests have all been peaceful, and I think everybody can celebrate that happened, that the process went smoothly.
Well, now with one election over, Ben, all eyes are on to the next political decision that needs to be made, mm-hmm. and that's Harris's Senate seat. There are not that many statewide offices, given the size that California is. There's a big pool of talent. What's the early word on where Newsom is going to be going in terms of who he's thinking about for that seat?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's such a powerful responsibility that the governor has. And I saw a conversation with his predecessor, with Jerry Brown, who said that it's just such a rare and awesome responsibility. So I think that, you know, some of the thoughts here are that just the way we've been talking about how Kamala Harris is a real groundbreaker in many, many ways, right? Because she's a woman, because she's a black woman, because she has she comes from South Asian descent. And she carried all of that, of course, as a senator. And while California does have two women senators and has had for quite a long time, I think that there's a lot of interest in having a woman as a senator. And one possibility along those lines is Karen Bass, who got a lot of attention because she was considered to be a possible running mate for Joe Biden. She is a congresswoman and she is from L.A., and she's a black woman. And so she's one person who could be on a short list. If you look up here in the Bay Area, you could also consider Barbara Lee. I'm really interested to talk with her to see if she's been approached about this. She's been a congresswoman since 1998. She's been in the state Senate, and she's also a black woman and a real progressive, of course, with her history. But I think that the front runners, it seems to me from what I've heard, are actually two Latinx men. And one of them is Alex Padilla, who is the current California Secretary of State. And he has served in the California Senate. He is young, he's Hispanic, and he's a good friend to Gavin Newsom. And he's gotten a lot of publicity this year, too, and a lot of name recognition because of the U.S. Census, of course. And then as Secretary of State in this election, he's been in the media quite a lot as well. And the other person who has been, and I was fascinated when he was appointed to this role, when Donald Trump was elected president, but Javier Becerra, the Attorney General of California, has filed over 100 lawsuits against the Trump administration. And so he has been in the media quite a lot also. He used to be a U.S. congressman. He was in the state assembly as well. And so because he was one of the leaders in California being kind of the resistance to federal policies and the federal government, I think that he's a real high-profile choice who could be appointed. Now, also, seat will come up for re-election in 2 years. And I think that that's a consideration that Newsom needs to make as well, who's re-electable.
Well, and actually, Ben, I might have seen the same interview that you saw with Jerry Brown, former governor, who made an interesting point, if you were watching the same interview, maybe you saw it too, that if he appointed someone who's a constitutional officer in California, elected statewide, to this open U.S. Senate seat, he would then be able to appoint someone to also replace that office. So in other words, if he appointed Xavier Becerra to the U.S. Senate seat, he could then appoint a new state attorney general, kind of giving Newsom a twofer. And it seems to me that might lean in more in favor of Becerra over Padilla, because the AG position is sort of a higher profile stepping stone. So any thoughts about that?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, where the dominoes fall in that way. I mean, personally, I think because Becerra really did take on this role of strong responsibility and, you know, is kind of, in a way, a counterpoint figure to the whole Trump movement. I mean, you know, to some extent, you know, even though Trump, presuming that Biden will be inaugurated on January 20th, 2021. And, you know, I'm kind of waiting to see what happens between now and then before I think of that as a done deal. But if you have somebody like Becerra in the U.S. Senate, then some of these people who are, you know, in the U.S. Congress now, in QAnon, for example, that he could be a counterpoint to that and provide that kind of really strong voice, strong perspective from California.
That's a great point. Well, that was Ben Trefney, KALW News Director. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben.
Thank you for hosting.
All right. And this is Ethan Elkon on behalf of my co-host, Grace Wan. We're so happy you could join us for this pre-speech coverage before President-elect Joseph Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, the Bay Area's own, give their speeches at 5 o'clock now that they have both been called by the networks as winners of the 2020 election. Thanks so much for joining us, and stay tuned now for national NPR coverage. This is KALW San Francisco.